Welcome to What's the Story with my guest this week, Jane Dennis, who's the author of Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli. So, Jane, how long have you been writing?
You know, I was thinking about this. I don't think I ever stopped writing. I started writing diaries when I was a child, which were complete nonsense. Have you ever revisited your teenage diaries?
Yes.
Absolutely excruciating. But I just wrote, and I think looking back, it's been more a form of, this is going to sound a bit weird, a form of therapy. Mm-hmm. It's always been an opportunity for me to get things off my chest, just to articulate real passions. So when I was in love or when I fancied somebody, and you know that intensity when you're a kid, and anger, just to get things down. So rather than just saying, this is how I feel, I would create a story around emotions. So things just generated from there.
And do you share those with your children now? Maybe it helps them through difficult patches that they go through or just general growing up?
Yeah. Now, my children are 9 and 11. My daughter definitely has a passion for writing. My son, not at all. But she definitely likes to write stories and creativity, but I don't think I've ever thought of it about coaching her as it some kind of form of therapy. But maybe that's a way forward. Maybe that's the parenting skill that I lack.
But your book, The Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli, is quite fun. It's quite out there.
Do you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it. It did actually make me cry at one point.
That's so a good thing,
you owe me for that. I'm not sure. But so what actually gave you the idea? Because it's about a schoolboy who is very good at long jump and his story of his grandfather sort of nurturing him through. So what gave you that idea?
I don't think consciously I went out with a specific story in mind, but I think many of my stories come from something in my subconscious. So I don't draw inspiration specifically from people I see in the street. I hear a lot of writers say, oh, I met this character and I adapted certain traits of that character and turned them into something in my book. I lived with my grandparents when I grew up. That might have had something to do with it. I'd been on a holiday to Sri Lanka, and the main protagonist is from Sri Lanka, as is his grandfather. My mum was a single mum, and the character's mum is a single mum. She's adopted Nathan, who's the main protagonist. So maybe these things come into play, but it's certainly something that I didn't consciously.
You're not a secret athlete.
No, but actually I did. Now there is the thing. I want to do something about competition and competition being something that's good in many ways, but actually not something that should take off over our lives. The premise of the story is about saying that, you know, we are competitive and we should be driven, but at the end of the day, the most important thing is the relationships in our life and how we manage those relationships and the people around us. And this is the whole underlying point of the story, that the main protagonist is really driven to succeed in athletics, in long jump. I did long jump at school. That was what I did quite well. So I knew a little bit about it from a technical perspective, but less from the competitive side.
But what about the gods of Cantrelli? I don't want to give away too much, but how did you come up with them? Even their names are quite something. They're, you know, like a game of charades trying to say some of them, indeed.
So yes, there's these fictitious gods which Pim Pam creates in order to give Nathan these life lessons. And we're not really sure why Pim Pam does this, but essentially it's to help Nathan through life. So is this a real religion? Is this a fictitious religion? But we know ourselves as readers that it's not a real religion that we're familiar with. And when you start to hear the names of the gods, so we have a god who is the hammer, who's god of a good night's sleep, we kind of work out that it's something that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But yeah, I didn't these things just come into my head, and I don't know, everything's from my imagination. I don't consciously get inspiration from anywhere.
So what, you literally started to write and, you know, Nathan emerged and the gods emerged as he came across a problem?
Absolutely. And I think, and this is what's great about writing, is that you can come across an obstacle and think, oh, I need a god to give him some advice now. Who would be this god? What would they do? What would they look like? And make it as ridiculous as possible. and the characters form and grow. I think I come across a character, and then it's a wonderful thing, and probably a bit egocentric, that you can just maneuver this character to whichever way they go. But I find they have such an identity that in themselves that there's certain things they wouldn't do. And it sounds a bit naff in many ways, but I feel the character leads the story.
And so he was speaking to you in a sense, that he tells you, no, no, I'm going this way.
Oh, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? it just sounds terrible and so not like the pragmatist that I am. And in life, I love a plan and I love a project. But when I write, I love the experience of just being taken off in any direction by a character who's telling me, they just tell the story. You know them so well, you know where they're going to take you.
Do you sort of add him to your list of children? Did you sort of think, ah, and I have to consider Nathan? Or did he become part of your family in that sense?
In my real life?
Yes. Yeah.
No.
No.
That's a really weird question.
No, I'm sorry. I just, when I write, I have my characters, I wonder what they're doing. If I'm not writing with them, I wonder what they're up to.
I find sometimes as well, I mean, you're a writer, and I find sometimes that I think about some of the characters that I've written over the years, and I've written hundreds of characters, whether they're published, unpublished, or just a slight story, and I think about them, and I find it bizarre that world, that village, that individual, that dog, that street doesn't exist anywhere outside of my imagination.
I think it'd be great, actually, if we could get together all of the unused or unpublished manuscripts in everybody's drawer or, you know, hard disk now, and all of those stories merged together, what kind of movie or book we would actually come up with. I think it would be quite fun.
We'd all get locked up, probably.
So how do you go about actually writing? Do you say, okay, it's 4 o'clock, kids are fed, I'm going to go downstairs and...
Yeah,
the Roald Dahl type
of writing. And who else was the same as well? Ernest Hemingway. You know, they had this real structure around writing. I think Roald Dahl used to write 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening every day at the same time, Christmas Day, whatever. He'd toddle off down to his shed and do that, which is a great thing to do. But that sounds very much like the luxury of a white middle class man to me. So, yes, I write when I can. And I have a notebook by the side of my bed. I have a notebook in my bag all the time. If I've got work going on, paid work going on, then that has to take priority, and the children take priority, and everything takes priority. So when I'm in a project, when I'm writing a book, you find time for that. I find time for that. I make sure that gets done. And there's some real drive and momentum behind that. But no, I don't have structure anymore. I write when I need to write.
Do you have a sort of special place in your home to write, or do you escape somewhere else and just take your machine and run away and just write somewhere quiet? Or can you do it while there's the normal life going on in the household?
Yeah, I can write. Well, I can write. I'm quite capable of writing anywhere, whether it's any good or not, I don't know. I mean, once upon a time, every Friday I would go and sit for 5 hours and write, but it was the only time I ever had any real structure to my writing.
And is that constant? You sit down and just go? Or does there come a point where, in this case, you know, Nathan would do something or get to a point you think, OK, he's going to sleep now, he can go to sleep. And I can go off and do whatever else I have to do and wait till he wakes up to start the next chapter?
There's a theory, isn't there, that, you know, and I think that was Roald Dahl again, which said, you know, just stop after 2 hours, and it doesn't matter if you're in the middle of something and you know where you're going to go with it, because you will pick up that energy and momentum next time. I don't know if I subscribe to that. I'll just write and write. But I find personally that after 2,000 words, I'm pretty spent. And I think anything that I write after that is generally going to be drivel. So
you have to revisit and you can see that was that o'clock or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's have a little bit of a listen to an excerpt of Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli.
Good, yes. So where was this? This is set at a stage where Pim Pam, the grandfather, has to go into hospital. And that's not a spoiler. He's an older man and he goes into hospital. And this is Nathan's opinion of the hospital when he arrives. And in advance, apologies for the terrible Sri Lankan accent. The hospital smelt like a mixture of our cleaner, who smelt like a mixture of bleach and washing up liquid, and warm mashed potato. There were a lot of people all wearing lots of different coloured uniforms, all holding bits of paper and walking slowly. It looked like a cool place to work, as no one seemed to be doing much except talking to someone else in another coloured uniform. Mum had me by the hand and was marching me down along a corridor, which had a green stripe along the wall. Then we went through some big doors and the stripe turned purple. Pim Pam's ward was off a yellow striped corridor. The ward was bright and white, and I could tell we were getting closer to the mash. A woman in a dark blue uniform talked to Mum as I watched a man in a brown uniform hand out plates of food to old men in beds. I looked for Pim Pam and I couldn't see him anywhere. Mum got hold of me again and took me to a small room opposite the kitchen where Pim Pam was sitting up in bed. His skin looked very dark against the washed-out yellow of the blankets. He had pyjama top open and several round stickers stuck to his chest, and they all had wires which hooked up to a wearing machine next to him. Thankfully, he didn't look like he was about to die. I did a small wave from the end of the bed and Mum stood behind me as though I was protecting her. "Look at this." He pointed to a plate of food on a tray next to his bed. "They want me to eat that." "Would you eat that? I am a sick man, and yet they want to feed me something I wouldn't give to a dog on the street." "Can I get you something else?" asked Mum, still behind me. "You can get me the police. They're trying to kill me with that stuff." I started laughing, although part of me wanted to cry. "I've spoken to the ward sister," said Mum, in her cheerful, helpful voice. "She says the consultant has been giving you some good news." "If you mean he says that I have a good heart, then yes. He says I'm fit and strong and that I should be home soon, thanks to the gods. But also that perhaps you should make some changes to your diet." Mum didn't like to tell Pimpam anything, so she did it by asking him questions they both already knew the answers to. She did this with me too. "You think I should eat vegetables? Yes? Live like a rabbit? What man wants to live 100 years as a rabbit?" Mum shook her head. What she said was, "You need to lower your salt intake and perhaps do some more exercise." Pah! That conversation was over. He looked at me. "Why are you not at school?"
So thanks for that. That's an excerpt of Jane Dennis's book, Pimpam and the Gods of Cantrelli. The story itself, we've said, is set in Sri Lanka. You said you went there on holiday and it had such an effect on you then that you used that as the inspiration, or it just became...
I don't know. Again, I don't know. I went to Sri Lanka where my husband's uncle lived, and he was telling us these stories about during the tsunami and what a terrible time it was. And he played a really pivotal part in the resurrection of the local village. So he was quite a key man in the organisation of the retrieval of a lost infrastructure, and he built a new village of 80 to 100 houses. And he just had all of these stories about terrible things that happened to kids out there. And maybe, again, subconsciously, it was something that resonated. But again, it's not something that I consciously thought about.
Do you think about your characters now that the book is finished and it's published and other people are living with them? Do you think about them at all? Or is it like, no, that's, I have another book going on now, I'm not worried about them anymore. They're done.
I have this thing where when I read a book and I think I'd like to talk to the author and ask them their thought process and the questions that you're asking me and think about to get another angle on the dimension of the characters. But actually, when people do that with me, I don't have the answers for them because I do what every other author does, which is say, well, what did you think about them? How did you see them? I know how I saw them, but how did you see them? Which always infuriates me when writers say that. But that's how I feel when I look at or introspect over my own characters. I know them and I feel I know them. But we would say that of all the people that we know, we have a view about our friends that other people don't have a view about. So I've created these people and I've given them out, and then it's for everybody else to judge whether they like them, don't like them.
And you don't think about them afterwards. It's the book is now on the shelves and the book is, yeah, that's it, the story is finished. Yes. You go on to set the new set of characters.
Yes, yes.
What are you actually working on now then? What are you?
Well, I'm resurrecting something that I wrote before. So I've written four novels and one of which I think is ready to go out, and it's not a tween novel. I mean, this book, I thought I was writing a children's book, but more adults like it than children. But I think it's on two levels, and people get what they want from it. So I think adults see a certain amusement in it that might wash over children. But with the other book, it's very much an adult book, and it's based on a woman who's experiencing kind of a breakdown, and she moves to Malta after undertaking a terrible deed, which we find out she's killed her husband, but not in such an obvious way that we might think that murder or foul play is afoot. Not necessarily so.
This could actually be a true story.
I killed my husband and I moved to Malta.
No, but you do wonder what people's backstories are, yeah. why they always get up and move so suddenly. But that's that's in your book.
But that was set in Malta simply because it's just easier to set it in Malta. I wanted this woman to escape a life in London, and I could have put her anywhere in the globe. But then why would I make it more difficult for myself when I can talk about places in Malta, a place where I've lived for 10 years?
If you've just joined us, you're listening to What's the Story with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Jane Dennis, the author of Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli. So you said you have four novels you'd written before Pim Pam. One you've resurrected. Why did you print Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli first? What made that one ready to go and the others not quite ready to go?
Yeah, good question. How do you know? I think it's a case of getting to a certain age and having a degree of confidence that I didn't have before. I mean, I wrote my first book, you know, on a notepad when I was in my 20s, and it's great. You know, the story's great. I read the dialogue, but I was so allowed to be controlled by other people and manipulated by other people and led to think that I wasn't ready. I didn't have enough confidence in my writing, but when I look at it, it's great. And I read books that are published now and think, yeah, well, my first book was like that. Maybe it's not a book I'd read now, and maybe the writing isn't perfect. Well, find a perfect writer. But I genuinely think I got to a stage, and I wish I'd learned, had the confidence, even 20 years ago, Monique, to just get out there and give it a go, because it is hard. You get knocked back, but you get knocked back in everything in life. Everything puts you back, but you will get to a time in your life, and I'm not saying age necessarily gives it to you. It could be experience, could be anything. You get to a stage in your life where you just think, you know what, I don't care. I could rewrite Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli over and over again. I read it now and I read a page or a line and I think I'd change it, but it's done and I'm happy with it. People like it and I'm moving on to the next thing. If we analysed absolutely everything we'd ever done in our lives, we'd probably do it all differently.
And you also have to think as well, there's the whole publishing gang that, you know, you employ as well. So
yeah,
you're not going to be able to publish a book that actually isn't going to make it unless you're self-publishing or, yeah, you know, vanity publishing. But realistically, if it sells, it, yeah, sells, and there's your vindication either way. So this first book that you wrote on this notepad, is that one of the ones you're going to bring back to life to publish?
I'd love to do that. It would be, it's a great story, and there's some great characters and there's some great writing in there, interspersed with a lot of rubbish, I suspect. But it's such a great story. And I read books now and I think, oh, you know, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have taken it in that direction. I compare it back to some of the books and stories that I've written. So I don't know whether those things are put to bed or not. I'd like to think not. But then part of me thinks, well, why would I go back and revisit that when I've got so much that I'm dying to do as well? It's a juggling act. I don't know.
Have a pipeline of novels ready to come out that would feed
don't worry about that. That's fine. Yeah, that's not a problem. I think productivity and ideas, I'm not lacking in, but like many writers, you know, it's not naturally. It is for me, fortunately, and possibly for you as well, being a businesswoman and a writer, you have the balance of understanding commercial viability, yes, twinned with creativity, and you're not naive enough to think that I'm just a mad woman with mad hair and 20 cats knocking out books, and then I don't know what to do with them, because I recognise that you have to have a commercial element, I recognise there needs to be marketing, traction, all of that. But looking back on some of my other stuff, whether I've got the desire to do that now or whether I can, or the momentum, I don't know. But I do get both sides of that now, and it's becoming harder. I think what I'd say to any writer is to get published now, or to get a deal, or to get traction in the traditional media, i.e. to get published and to get an agent, comes with fame. So if you've got an established name as a writer, you're okay. If you're David Walliams and you're a very famous comedian in the UK, I'm sure he's got great talent. My kids love him too, but you'll get published. If you create one book that's got a potential seven books on the back of it as well, there's great traction. But that's it. So then and less people are reading and less books are being published. So the smaller though that hole is, the harder it is to penetrate that hole. So it's not a great world to get into.
But there are more options now with the gambit of self-publishing options. ebooks, audiobooks, yeah. there's less costs involved, so there's less risk indeed for on the side of the publishers.
But I think for me it's more about the how you get readers. So there's a lot on the market that is unfiltered. So you can go down the self-publishing route and be absolutely amazing. But if nobody knows about it,
yes,
it
your
might
marketing
as well not
still
be
has
there.
To be strong. Sort
and
of.
There's a lot of people who just write what's on the top of their heads and then get it self-published. So you're up against that as well in this traditional perception of what self-publishing is, which is not necessarily a viable perspective anymore.
Right. And it's not something you can live off anyway, like you say. So it's almost a hobbyist, a hobby thing to do.
How many times have you heard you'll be the next J.K. Rowling?
No, never actually.
Oh, sorry. I hear that all the time.
How happy you are.
But when people say, you know, that if you say you're a writer, that they just immediately think that that's the potential, which is...
I had my first book rejected as many times, I think, and I just put it to bed after that. I gave up. But there we go. The second book came out and that one's doing okay. But I don't have the resilience, I don't think. What tips would you give budding writers? What would you tell them to do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, to actually, if they think they have a book in them?
Write. Just write and write and write. And if you enjoy writing a lot, then write a novel. If you like writing dialogue, write a script. If you have great stories but you don't like writing dialogue, write a format. There's so many options now, like you say. But sooner or later, you will have to hone it down to one thing and find out if it's marketable or not. And that, I think, is the toughest part, because if you're creative, you'll do it, and you'll do it because you want to do it. But getting it in front of other people is a completely different skill set. And you've just got to go for it. And if you're younger, which most listeners would be here, is really believe in yourself, because it doesn't matter how old you are. It really doesn't matter how old you are. And it would be really silly to get to an age where life becomes obsessively busy and you've left it too late for somebody to dust off that thing that's under the bed.
And I think one of the good things is that no one else knows you've been rejected apart from you if you don't go on radio and tell people.
I can't keep it to myself.
But no, nobody knows. Like, oh, that wasn't rejected 12 times before. Yes. Nobody knows unless you tell them. So, yes, you have to work out a way to stomach it, but nobody knows that. Any other tips, any other sort of guidelines, a way of developing a character, a plot development? Are there any things that you...
I don't, you know, there's loads of models out there, you know, the 8-point arc and all of these things that you're supposed to do. But I think if you watch enough TV and read enough, you get that, you know, there is a natural flow. I spent ages trying to find out what these things were. So I wrote naturally first. And then I studied it. I did my degree. I did my bachelor's in philosophy and creative writing.
Okay.
And, do you know, apart from the practice, I wouldn't say there was anything that I actually learned. I did more of it and I understood the terminology behind it and I looked at evidence of other people doing it. But did I really become a better writer? Some people might say I did. And I was encouraged to do it by a literary agent. She said, hone your craft. Personally, I just think the more you write, the better
anyway.
You get. Yeah.
And what else? Do you read a lot?
I don't read as much as most writers say that I should read. So I have people who aren't readers see me as a big reader. Writers and readers would not see me as a big reader. Some people churn through books. I probably read one or two books a month. And I must admit, I prefer fact to fiction.
Okay.
Sometimes I get a bit distracted by plot and character and the thinness of plot or the unbelievability of dialogue, that it can distract me a little bit. I like fact, I like to learn. And you know, talking about tips, and I think the more life experience you've got, this sounds really lame and I feel like a real old fart. But I think if you do a lot, you live a lot, you meet lots of people, you read a lot of fact, fiction, anything, or you just digest everything that's going on around you. I'm terrible for picking up people's habits and mannerisms. I'm distracted by them to extent, you know, verbal tics, physical tics. Then it's easy to visualise a character without making it an individual person. This just takes hold. If you're that person, that's what you'll do.
So what sort of factual books do you read?
Goodness. Feminism, politics, history.
Politics. You're fun to be around.
A bag of laughs. I sound crikey. Philosophy. Economics.
Do you have a book in every room, or are you one of the, you focus on books, one book at a time and
everywhere? No, I only read one at a time because I'm flighty enough. I don't need chaos everywhere. But there's books all over my house. We don't have a television, so the kids read, which is really nice. I don't know why I'm so smug about that, but I like the fact my children read, and I read. It's just it's nice, and it's good to immerse yourself in a completely different world. It's healthy.
And do you go off in a corner and read quietly, or again, you can just carry on with the rest of the family doing whatever they're doing? And
when you've got children and they've got clubs, it's really nice to have something to do in the car while they're fencing / doing ballet / whatever it is. all of the above.
Long jump, maybe.
Yes, long jump.
And do you have any favourite books? Any books that stuck in your mind that you keep or you revisit or?
One book I read a great book recently by Donna Tartt, The Goldfinch. Did you read that?
No.
That's a great book. That's a really interesting book of late. But no, and I've never been one to. I will watch films over and over again, but I've never reread a book.
Okay.
Which you do?
I do. I have a book I read almost every year, The Wind in the Willows.
Really?
And every year I find something different in it, and it's strange because it will be somewhere you visit or you realise there's something that you've always wanted and you realise it's in the book and that must have embedded itself from childhood.
Yeah.
And I keep reading it and think, well, I want a gypsy caravan, you know, and there's a gypsy caravan. Or I visited Alassio. So there's these things that pop up and you think, okay, it's in the book. So it doesn't matter how many times I read it, I still seem to find something. And that's for me, lovely. If I get a bit homesick, I miss England. I need to go to my Wind in the Willows and just cozy up. Oh, at the riverbank.
That's a really nice idea. I think the only book I felt like that with is Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat.
Okay.
Have you read it?
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely hilarious. Yeah. Still makes me laugh. It's so satirical.
So he's one of your favourite authors, or you have many, many?
I don't look at an author, to
be honest.
You don't
go one after the other. No, you don't read everything they write.
No.
But you hope somebody's going to do it with your work, obviously.
Of course they are, yes, naturally.
It's been really good fun. You've been listening to myself, Monique Chambers, and Jane Dennis, the author of Pim Pam and the Gods of Cantrelli, on Campus FM's What's the Story? Thank you for listening.